Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is one of the early introductory courses of the Free Enterprise Institute. By early, I refer to the fact that this was the second course we ever had in our curriculum. This is meant to be both an introduction to our main course, V50, and at the same time, it's also a historical supplement to that same course. The Free Enterprise Institute, for those of you that are new to the subject, is an organization whose purpose is to achieve freedom in this world, in this time. The subject of the American Revolution is, without doubt, of interest to this particular pursuit for the reason that what occurred in the period of time that is usually referred to as the American Revolution is, in the teachings of the Free Enterprise Institute, the only historical antecedent to the subject of freedom. There has never been anything in the past history of the human race other than the American Revolution that could claim to be a movement of bona fide liberty. It is not the contention of this course, myself, or the Free Enterprise Institute to say that the American Revolution achieved freedom by any means, because if that were the case, we'd have a tough time explaining what's going on today. But as a matter of fact, I do have much light to shed on that, even though this is a short course. The subject of the American Revolution does cover the meaning of this movement with respect to a genuine total mechanism to achieve freedom. Maybe of interest to ask, well, why should we concern ourselves with history, the American Revolution or otherwise, if our object is freedom, especially since it didn't achieve it? It is because there are certain lessons to be learned from the American Revolution of 1776, which in fact are capable of shedding a great deal of light on what a bona fide concept of freedom is, and what the movement of the 18th century represented is a partial fulfillment of the proper mechanism. And before this short course is over, I think that it will be clear as to exactly wherein the American Revolution was on the right track, and to what extent and in what direction its shortcomings lay, and what we can do about it at this time. So it has a great value to us at this time, and has timely import even though it's 200 years in the past. I might also say that no other historical development can lay a claim to even being an antecedent to freedom, much less having any substantial contribution to make towards it. This course is three sessions. Its name is The Declaration of Independence, Thomas Paine, and Your Freedom, for reasons that will become very shortly apparent. The Declaration of Independence will cover most of the topic of the first session. Thomas Paine will cover most of the topic of the second session. Your Freedom will cover most of the topic of the third session. The three are intimately correlated and interrelated, and there is no clear-cut separation between them. I'll be talking about all three in all three sessions, but basically, the first session is to explain what the Declaration of Independence represents in history and in ideology and in principle. The second portion of this course is to demonstrate that the person who had the most to do with it, namely Thomas Paine, has a historical significance out of all proportion to that which has been thus far accorded him in the history books and in the so-called schools that we have. And the third part of the topic, Your Freedom, represents a correlation and integration on a small scale of how these historical concepts give you a clue as to what can be done to achieve freedom in the foreseeable and relatively short-term future. It is not possible in a short course such as this to explain everything in the detail that it deserves. The only thing that will be explained in more detail than it deserves in our longer course, V50, is the historical development, which we do not have time for in V50 except in a very cursory manner. This is, therefore, a supplement to that. Other than history, the ideological concepts can have to be abbreviated here. If you think that some of the statements made are positively stated, you are right. If you resent it, I suggest only you recognize that this is an extract, historically oriented extract from a longer course where everything that is asserted with positive vigor here is proven in detail without any question or reservation. And you must recognize that the purpose and scope of such a course as this is historical supplementation and introduction to a main course, which in turn, therefore, means that some of the more positive and more overwhelming conclusions have to be left on the basis that they are conclusions out of context. You might also ask, well, why teach the American Revolution? I've already had that in school. You didn't have this. What is going to be given in this course, you didn't have in your present school systems, regardless of where you happen to go. How am I sure of this? I'm quite sure of it because I didn't learn it in any school myself, and I never met a single person in my life where, regardless of where he went to school, by whom he was taught, whoever developed this before. And I might also say that Thomas Paine, the main individual described in this course, is not, in general, even mentioned very much in the regular school system. Just for my own curiosity, I'd like to see what percentage of you have even heard of Thomas Paine in the schools that you attended. All right? That's about half of the people here. And those half, that half of you that heard of Thomas Paine, was the treatment in great detail? Did you hear a great deal about Thomas Paine or just a passing mention? Now let me see how many of you heard of him in a great detail. Well, for example, who founded this country in history, per history course in ordinary school? George Washington. How many of you have heard of Thomas Paine in the same detail as you heard of George Washington? No more hands survived. I don't think anyone ever heard of Thomas Paine with the detail you hear of George Washington. Let me ask you an easier question. How many of you have ever heard of Thomas Paine in the same detail, with the same emphasis in your schooling, that is given to the current president? The current president, or whoever was currently president at the time you went to school, regardless of when that was. One of the things I wish to demonstrate in this course is that the founder of the United States Republic is Thomas Paine, and not George Washington. This is not meant disrespectfully towards George Washington. Quite the contrary, I have a rather high opinion of George Washington, and I'd like to give him every credit he deserves, but he doesn't deserve credit for founding this country. Nor does Thomas Jefferson, nor does John Adams, nor does any other of the so-called founding fathers. Not one of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, there being 56 signatures thereon, is the founder of the United States. They merely ratified and gave their personal approval to the founding document. Not one of them wrote it, including Jefferson, who is assumed to be the author. Is there anyone here who heard of the authorship of the Declaration of Independence as being anybody other than Thomas Jefferson in your schooling? How many of you ever heard of the Declaration of Independence? Start there. Okay. All of you have heard of the Declaration of Independence of the United States Republic? Good. Glad to hear it. Did you all realize before that someone wrote it? And that someone, of course, in most schools is taught as Thomas Jefferson. Am I correct? Anyone here otherwise? Elsewhere, I mean? Well, that's the point I'm making. Now, again, what I just said about George Washington applies even more so to Thomas Jefferson. What I'm teaching here has nothing to do with trying to produce any disrespect for Thomas Jefferson either. I have a high admiration for Thomas Jefferson also. And let's start that as a ground rule of this course. The purpose of this course is not to diminish the reputation of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, or any other person connected with the American Revolution, but it is to elevate to the proper perspective the one who had more to do with it than all the others combined, without whom the others would have worked in vain. I will also hint perhaps later in the course as to why I think history has temporarily erased the importance of Paine, because our history books are not exactly unbiased in their authorship and as to their objective in writing. However, be that as it may, even elevating Thomas Paine to his proper position in history is not the main purpose of this course either, although it does justify offering it as a history course in the sense that it is differently developed and everything that is stated here is a historical development you are free to check upon. I leave you with your own rational mentality to determine whether or not you indeed find that the proofs offered fit the facts and whether the facts fit the hypothesis offered. More than a hypothesis, it's corroborated. That makes it a theory. But the proofs, as I say, are available to you, same sources that I shall be quoting. There are other things which are not in this course, such as the conclusions that will be developed at the end, in the third session, which incidentally is the most important part of the course, the third session. In the third session, it will be developed what the purpose of bringing up the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Paine is. Elevating Paine to his proper perspective in history is not only doing justice to a man who has been dealt with unjustly in history, but also will give us some insight as to some very important intellectual techniques and methods that will carry us out of the political mess that we are in and from which there is no way out by means that are presently on the horizon. If you analyze what Thomas Paine did and find how it differs from what his contemporaries and those who came after him did, you'll get a clue that there is a more effective mode of operation than you have been previously accustomed to thinking in terms of. And although Paine himself was only, you might say, experimenting or performing gropings in the direction of a superior technique, where he was most successful, he used a superior technique to all of his contemporaries. And where he adopted the methods of his contemporaries, he too failed. There were two times in Paine's life when he had a miserable experience. Both of them were involved in political action. And those are the times when he failed. And when he succeeded, he did not use normal political procedures as his contemporaries did. And this is exactly the main thrust of this course to demonstrate this. First of all, I want to emphasize, before I even discuss its importance, that the Declaration of Independence, which is the main philosophy and document of this course, Paine being the main character of this course, the Declaration of Independence is not, as you have undoubtedly been informed elsewhere, is not a political document. It is an ideological document. There is not a single thing in the entire Declaration of Independence that has a political flavor in it. There is not a party referred to or even intuitively implied. There is not a single faction, partisanship. There is no popular election referred to. There is no legislature referred to. There is no executive referred to. And there is no judiciary referred to. The only political character even hinted at, and that's a pretty broad hint, is the King of England, and he is soundly denounced. And he is looked upon as the villain of the piece, and he is ideologically trounced as no individual has ever been, and I might add, few people deserved it more. But all of the flavor of the Declaration of Independence, from beginning to end, stresses principle. Actually, the first third of the Declaration of Independence is the sound, I should say the significant part of it. The rest is merely a bill of specifics as indictments against the British king and the particular political structure that the British king represents. The first third of the Declaration of Independence represents the American Revolution. You ask me what I mean by the American Revolution. I mean exactly the first third of the Declaration of Independence. Now, it may come as a shock to you that I don't normally speak the same language that most people do, and so we better familiarize ourselves on that subject right at the beginning. I'm sure that most places where you hear the words American Revolution, you will think of certain things that I do not mean. What does come to mind to most people when you hear the expression American Revolution? Most people think of that as the war against Great Britain. Most people think of the struggle for independence from Great Britain, and the overthrow of the British regime in America and the establishment of an independent republic. This is what is in most popular imaginations or popular acceptances of what happened referred to as the American Revolution. This is not what I mean by the American Revolution. And I will refer to this, these things that I just outlined and enumerated, by other terms. I will give other names. We don't confuse semantics and use one name to mean something which means something entirely different. The war against Great Britain I will refer to as the war for independence. The rebellion against the British rule I will refer to just that way, the rebellion. This might help clarify the distinction between three different things, the rebellion, the war for independence, and the revolution. When would you say the revolution began? Most people who think in terms of military events would pinpoint the date as April 19th, 1775, which is the time during which the hostilities began at the famous battles of Lexington and Concord following the midnight ride of Paul Revere. This is when the first shot was fired, which in poetry is called the shot heard around the world. This is when the first time the American colonists said to the British king, in effect, "You may stop your molestation, We mean to fight you, and we have had enough of your tyranny. This is the first time the American colonists, you might say, as individuals, declared war. May I point out to you that the United States did not declare war against Great Britain on April 19, 1775, for a very simple reason. There was no United States. These were individual human beings who said they will not take any more guff from a tyrant, and they rebelled. Now, that we're here in America, in a country which is now separate from Great Britain, and we call these people patriots, and perhaps rebels against Great Britain. But supposing you were an Englishman, what would you have called them? Traitors. From the British point of view, these people were traitors. I might add that is a standard dichotomy that exists at all times there is a conflict. From one point of view, it's patriotism and heroic. From the other point of view, it's treason and possibly looked upon as cowardly. Now, of course, I would say that this was patriotic and heroic. But I want to point out why. Because in a sense of more than personal opinion, the Americans were right and the British were wrong. And that is not because of which side of the ocean I happen to live in. Even a rational Englishman today would recognize that the Americans were right for reasons completely beyond ordinary concepts of national pride and origin. There were things there that transcended merely opinions and personal prejudices and favorings of one or the other side. There are ways you can tell the difference between right and wrong, which this course is not the proper place to put, but is in our long course. And I don't wish to continue saying that throughout the three sessions, so I would like to make that as a blanket ground rule, recognizing that many, many basic principles cannot be put into a historical short course, and what I just said applies to many other strong statements I shall be making in the next two sessions. Namely, that whether something is right or wrong is not a matter of opinion. It is not relative to who says it or where he lives or when he lives. This is an absolute which can be stated with extreme precision. In 1775, the Americans were right and the British were wrong. And this is not an American opinion versus a British one. From a local patriotic relative position, it was arbitrary. From an absolute position, the Americans were right because they stood for a larger and increasing amount of freedom, which is not yet here defined, but which we'll be coming towards later in this short course. Because they stood on the side of freedom, or more accurately, they were closer to the perspective of freedom, it can be said that they were right. As to why freedom represents rightness, that's also, unfortunately, beyond this short course of scope. Now let's analyze the next point. The rebellion began on April 19, 1775. Where is the revolution? There isn't any yet. When did the revolution begin? Let's ask an easier question. When did the war for independence begin? Well, obviously when the colonists not only said we're going to fight the British, but we're going to fight them to the point where we don't want them back. And they declared independence as a nation. And that, as you know from the history books, is July 4, 1776, and I won't upset that too much. The fact that it was really July 2nd and they put the wrong date on is beside the point. You can say July 4, 1776 is close enough. That's the beginning of the war for independence. The rebellion was now converted into a war for independence. The question is, when did the revolution begin? Well, before we can answer such a question, it would be a nice idea if we knew what we're talking about. What is a revolution, anyhow? A revolution, not as most people believe, is a peaceful thing. There was no peace. There was a war going on. And yet revolutions are peaceful. Now, this is not common usage, I will grant you. People use words like revolution for such things as the Russian Revolution, meaning the upheaval in Russia in 1917 when the communists took over. They talk about the French Revolution, which was followed by bloodletting and head chopping. They talk about the revolution in Cuba when Batista gets kicked out in favor of another thug called Castro. They call it a revolution when, in general, dictator A gets kicked out by dictator B in country Z. This is ridiculous. Every time something like this happens, it's called a revolution. None of these are revolutions, including what happened in Russia, and including even what happened in France, although that came closer. And this course, even though it's mainly on America, has a great deal to say about what is called the French Revolution as well, for the simple reason that Thomas Paine was embroiled in both. Was not equal success. He had uneven success. But I will be discussing the French Revolution later, and that came closer to being a real revolution, but missed the boat. A true revolution has nothing to do with violence. Absolutely nothing. As a matter of fact, the less violence there is, the closer you are to having a revolution. Why? Let's analyze what the word revolution means. What does the word revolution mean? It means a turning around. If you check back in your etymology of the word revolution, you will find, by looking into a proper dictionary, that the word revolution comes from Latin roots meaning turning around. This is easy to apply, for example, to such things as, let's say, physical situations. You've heard the expression, the revolution of the earth around the sun. Nobody's shot here. It's a peaceful thing. It's a turning of the planet around the sun. It's going around it. Or the revolution of any body around that axis of rotation. It's a turning around. Now that is exactly what revolution correctly means. To apply military violence to it is a distortion. Now why do people think that when somebody gets shot, that's a revolution? Because in the primitive mind of the average person, with religious fanaticism it is believed, that the way to get things done is to get the bad guy out and get the good guy in. And since the bad guy won't leave peacefully, you've got to kick him out with a pitchfork. Or maybe shoot him. Or chop his head off. Or do something else. Since the bad guy won't leave voluntarily, you've got to use force on him. And so, since you've always had bad guys running the world, and since you've always had kings and dictators and thugs ruling ordinary people who wish to be let alone, for this reason, it became prevalent that when a bad guy gets kicked out in any country whatsoever, it is immediately assumed, well, a revolution has occurred, we've got the thing turned around in our favor. Until you wait a little while, and you find that the new fellow, the good guy, quote unquote, he turns into a bad guy too, just give him time enough. And he does all the characteristics of violence that the old fellow had, and you're back to where you start. So you need a new revolution. Well, on this basis, you gotta keep turning around always. You never get anywhere. Now I got a better concept of revolution for human conduct and human society and so forth. A proper concept of revolution is to recognize that the human social organization can exist in two postures only. Either man is free and is fully in control of himself and his own life and that those things that he develops and his own destiny, or he isn't. If he is fully in control over himself, then he can call himself free. This is not particularly specific at this moment, but it'll do for the present. If a man is in control over his own life and that which is derived from his life, then you can call him free. And if all men are in this condition, where they control themselves and not others, you can call that condition freedom. Well, that's one position that man can be in. There's another. Anything else? Where somebody else, I don't care who he is, I don't care if he's blonde or brunette, or redheaded or bald. I don't care whether he is white or black or purple. I don't care whether he's 5 feet tall or 8 feet tall. I don't care whether it's male or female, rich or poor, smart or stupid, fat or thin, with mustache or without mustache, with beard or without beard. If someone else controls my property, I am not free. If someone else controls my life, I am not free. And the same is true for you. That's the other condition you can be in. Well, welcome aboard. That's the world you live in. The world you live in is where you are not free because you do not command your own destiny. And no one does. Not even the dictator. He only is partially in control over himself till one of his competitors runs against him and shoots him. Or by some other more refined technique, like voting, kicks him out. I mean, the same way. I mean, you get rid of the old guy and you put someone else in his place. I don't care how you do. You shoot him or you convince him you ought to resign or maybe you vote him out. But you get a new fellow running the show. Now, that would be a revolution. That would be a turning around, a social structure. That would be a turning around of the human social organization to produce a condition where individuals do not get controlled by others than themselves. Now, that is the ideological concept of a revolution. It has nothing to do with violence. And I maintain the more violence you use, the less results you accomplish in creating a revolution. Because every time you perform an act violently, that means someone else is injured, he is killed or damaged, and he loses control of part or all of himself. Under such conditions, you cannot eliminate anger, bitterness, jealousy, and desires for revenge. Under such conditions, you never solve problems. You merely postpone them, delay them, or transfer them. Under such conditions, you do not truly create a revolution. If you want a true change, one that turns man around into a different social position, then you must employ means whereby individuals are convinced that this will be more satisfactory from their standpoint than what is presently available. And they will desire the change and not merely accept it because they are at gunpoint or because they have been forced to accept it. There are two ways of getting people to act, to force them or to convince them. A revolution must use convictions and persuasion and not violence. And so true revolutions do not occur by violence. Now, there are some things in history that are called revolutions which are true revolutions. For instance, the Industrial Revolution is a true revolution. That changed man around from being a primitive animal which had to just barely cope with nature to the point where his minimum survival was hardly assured, and where if you wanted to have five children to grow to adulthood, you would probably have to start with 20 to make it possible to have maybe 4 or 5 survive, because most people didn't survive the rigors of famine, epidemics, malnutrition, destitution of a general scale. And so therefore, because of the poor social conditions, the improper amount of goods produced, inadequacy of ability to support a whole social culture, because of this, very, very few people were actually able to enjoy what is now called a good standard of living. And very few enjoyed their lives, and not everyone survived. And the population, by the way, did not grow, and there was no worry about a population explosion. Are you aware of this? There was no population explosion until 200 years ago. And there couldn't be. No one worried about this. This is a major problem today. And if today we're worrying about that the population of the earth expands at the present rate, pretty soon there'll be standing room only. I figured it out once. If the population expands at the same rate as it has for the past 200 years, in 700 years from now, there'll be one human being for every square foot of land on this planet. It's a little too crowded. There are solutions to this, but not through all ancient techniques. Now, that's a problem to worry about today. But most people don't know where that problem came from. There was no worry about a population explosion 200 years ago, and why not? Because the human race was not able to produce enough food to even take care of the people who lived then. And they were still hungry. The condition on a worldwide basis was somewhat similar to what it is now in China, where people are always hungry. But that was a universal concept at one time. Well, the Industrial Revolution was possible for certain reasons, which are not unconnected with the American Revolution. What is now called the Automation Revolution, or the Second Industrial Revolution, is a continuation of certain things which started 200, 250 years ago. As a matter of fact, what is called the American Revolution and what is called the Industrial Revolution, I will hope to have time to prove in this course, are not exactly two different things. They are actually different manifestations of the exact same thing. The American Revolution is a part of the same philosophy that the Industrial Revolution is, and they both have the same root. They came from the same source. How many of you can identify the intellectual source of both? One person and his achievements, Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton is the source of both the Industrial and the American Revolutions. And most Americans don't have the foggiest notion what Isaac Newton has to do with the American Republic. Well, this will be, I hope, clear before this is over, because you see, the one who founded this nation is Thomas Paine, for reasons that I will be demonstrating this and next session. And Thomas Paine was an intellectual disciple of Isaac Newton. And it's what he knew through Newton that made history, and not what he knew through politicians, legislators, and other assorted baloney throwers. It is not, in any sense, a political philosophy that Paine was developing. So much for that. Now the answer to the question I asked some minutes ago. When did the American Revolution begin? Depending exactly what you define as the American Revolution, if you define it as the beginning of a social philosophy which leads to freedom, you might point to Isaac Newton at the beginning of the American Revolution. If you want to, however, say, well, that's actually merely the intellectual foundation for the American Revolution, and it was not a direct occurrence, then you might, by trying to find a more specific act that was localized to what is now called America and the United States, you might pinpoint it more closely and more locally and more specifically as January 10, 1776. What happened on January 10, 1776? An idea was injected into human culture. That idea led to the Declaration of Independence less than 6 months later. That idea is this book called Common Sense. The particular book I'm holding aloft is an edition which has two books in one cover, Common Sense and The Crisis, both written by Thomas Paine. I'm referring at the moment to the first one, Common Sense. That was actually not even a book. It was a pamphlet. And depending on whether you look at the first edition or the later edition, it's under 50 pages or just about 50 pages. The expanded version was about 50 pages long. That philosophy that Paine wrote in there, in that pamphlet, booklet, is actually the philosophy of the American Revolution. The thoughts behind it, of course, were brewing for some time in his mind and also in the minds of other individuals. But this was the point of injection into society at the time of publication of this pamphlet. I'd like to point out that this led, in a short time, of 6 months only, less than 6 months, to a complete separation of the colonies from Great Britain. Now you may say, well, what's all this got to do with anything? Everybody knows that the American colonies separated from Great Britain. And what do you mean putting all this credit upon this one man? You mean to tell me you're ignoring the effect of Thomas Jefferson or George Washington or any of these people? Yeah, I'm not ignoring them. I'm just claiming they have nothing to do with the American Revolution. They have plenty to do with the rebellion. They have nothing to do with the revolution. They became revolutionists when Paine showed them it was proper to be revolutionists. I'd like to point out, ladies and gentlemen, that none of the so-called founding fathers of this country wanted what is now called the Declaration of Independence until Paine wrote Common Sense. That's a far-fetched story, ain't it? George Washington wasn't for independence. Is that what you're saying? Yes. I'm saying that George Washington was not for independence prior to Common Sense. I'm saying Thomas Jefferson was not for independence prior to Common Sense. I'm saying Benjamin Franklin was not for independence prior to Common Sense. And with independence from Great Britain came something greater. Because that isn't the full story. Independence from Great Britain wouldn't mean two hoots in a rain barrel if something else didn't come with it. And that is the sovereignty of the individual over the state, over what is called government. Lots of nations have become independent of other nations. But freedom did not come about. Perhaps you may have heard of the Belgian Congo. It's been in the news in the last 5 years quite a bit. Except it's no longer called the Belgian Congo. Today it's called the Congolese Republic, and it has secessionist provinces like Katanga. And there's been a lot of news. A lot of noise has been broadcast about the Congo. Has there been freedom in the Congo in the recent decade? They got rid of Belgium, didn't they? And the Congolese, the Lumumbas, and the other rabble-rousers there like to call themselves the George Washingtons of the Congo, didn't they? And how many other backward, underdeveloped, and primitive nations have thrown off the yoke of colonial masters in the last, let's say, 20 years since World War II? The entire British Empire has disintegrated. England has lost all of its colonies. France has lost most of its colonies. That mess in Vietnam, that used to be called French Indochina. Are the Vietnamese free? Or do we have to go there to bail them out? Or more accurately, the American state thinks we have to go there to bail them out of their problems, which is not the same thing. That was a French colony. Were there any Americans having to fight in French Indochina 30 years ago when the French had it as a simple colony? No. Now they're free of France. And not only are they not free as people, but Americans are practically involved in a major war, because a so-called colony is no longer a colony and has been mismanaged internally without freedom. The same is true of practically all of Africa, all of Oceanica, all of the so-called colonial nations which have emerged from Great Britain, France, Spain, Portugal, Holland, Belgium. All of these countries had colonies. And before World War I, Germany had colonies. Italy had colonies. All of these nations have had their colonies spring loose and declare their independence. Effectively and successfully have become independent political nations. And where is the freedom there? So I want to point out to you very, very emphatically, American independence from Great Britain has nothing to do with freedom. We could be just as much enslaved with an American king as with a British king, probably more so. And I'd also like to emphasize that the majority of the American colonists, when they were fighting to get rid of the British king, had in mind becoming an American monarchy with finding some local fellow to become a local ruler. But of course, he'd be a good guy because he's one of us. As a matter of fact, George Washington was the most prominent candidate mentioned for this little job of American king. And a very large number of American politicians were looking to the time when America becomes independent and we'll have a new King George, but it will be George Washington. As a matter of fact, applying the present political philosophy to that time, let me point out, using the political slogans of today, George III of Great Britain had it all over George Washington as King of America because, after all, he had more experience. And you know, that's one of the best arguments that incumbents offer to stay in office and be reelected. Don't change horses in midstream. Vote for, and you name the present incumbent and say, he has more experience. Now, if you want experience in ruling other people, well, let's take a good close look at Khrushchev. He's still alive. He's had lots of experience ruling people, if that's what you want. The point is, most people look upon rulership as a way of life, and they were looking to American monarchy. Now, you heard me say earlier that I think very highly of George Washington, even though I don't look upon him as the founder and father of this country. I mean it. I think very highly of him. I'll tell you now something very complimentary about George Washington. One of the reasons we don't have an American monarchy is because he wouldn't take the job if it were offered to him. Because every time a feeler was proposed to him, they were sounding him out. Well, how would he take to the idea if we make you king? He said no. He said flatly no. So that stands to his eternal credit. Now, I believe in giving everybody credit for what they did. Now, that is something George Washington did. He prevented the morons in this country from making him king by discouraging them. And since he was the most popular candidate for the job, that automatically put a damper on practically anybody else. Because if Washington didn't want it, it would have been pretty hard to make anyone else king. Incidentally, why was he so popular? Since he was not a very friendly person. His personality was not that of a good time Charlie. He was a sort of a more sober George. And he was a very sober fellow, and he didn't mix well in company, and he wasn't one of these, you know, universally liked characters. Why was he so popular? Well, because he was a general. And victorious generals are always popular. That's part of history. He was a soldier. And soldiers are always easily looked upon as heroes, better than thinkers. But be that as it may, George Washington had major personal characteristics of great integrity. He didn't want to rule. Okay. Now, of course, Paine wouldn't have liked him as king, but Paine wouldn't have had much to say about it since Paine wasn't as popular. Paine, after all, was only a thinker and a writer, and he wasn't a popular general. So even though Paine wouldn't have approved of George Washington being king, he couldn't really have stopped it if Washington had preferred it that way. So you might properly catalog much of the credit to Washington on this point. But basically, to return to the issue, the revolution was not the declaration of independence from Great Britain, but the declaration of independence of the individual from the state. This declaration of independence actually is a double document. You read it very carefully, as most people do not. This is a double declaration of independence. It's a declaration of independence from the British king on behalf of the 13 colonies, which become 13 states. It is also a declaration of independence of the individual as far as establishing self-sovereignty over what is called government. I think it's time we read the Declaration of Independence's first few sentences. Now, I know you've already heard it, but let's make sure we know what we're talking about here. I'm only going to read the first roughly one-third of it. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. I didn't hear anything like this from Lumumba, by the way, about laws of nature and things like this. He was just a political opportunist. You know, that's the Congolese George Washington, as he called himself. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such forms as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. That's all I shall read, except that to mention that the author of the Declaration goes on to say, but when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design, etc., etc., then he goes into his harangue against the British king as to what this joker has done. And then you really can't stand this, so now this requires a revolution. Well, so much in what I just read, let's see where we begin. First of all, please note, there is no designation here of a sovereign state. You read the rest of it also, isn't it? The only reference to a supreme being in here is called nature's God. There is no reference here to any one form of belief and religion being superimposed upon everyone else. This is simply a source of natural law, which, to the author of the Declaration of Independence, is the same for all men. And there is no specific individual form of belief in that God which is elevated above all others. Moreover, there is no sovereign state established or referred to. There are 13 colonies become states here, but not one of them is sovereign over any other, and more importantly, none of them are even sovereign over the human beings in that group of colonies or states. For instance, it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Please note that nobody is granting life, liberty, or pursuit of happiness or any other favor to any human being. These are unalienable rights derived from nature and the source of nature, the Creator. This has nothing to do with any favor or benefit given from on high from a state. Moreover, it doesn't say all men are equal. So let's get this very clear. It says all men are created equal. Now, I dare say there aren't five people who have ever had political office in the entire United States' history who understand that. I'm being very generous when I assume there might be as many as five who knew that. The only question I want to ask is, how come they were in office if they understood this? The present philosophy of our nation is such as to try to make every human being the equal of every other human being, and if they don't fit the pattern, chop them up. I remember once seeing a movie with the Marx Brothers, and I don't remember which one it was, and it doesn't really matter, but in this picture, Harpo Marx, that's the silent one, was putting together a jigsaw puzzle, and the pieces didn't fit. So he took out a pair of scissors and started cutting them up so as to make the pieces fit each other. And of course, when you get a picture put together on that basis, you can imagine what it looks like. You can't make out the pattern in the picture because the wrong pieces are next to the wrong ones, and you don't have a complete picture anyhow. Well, that's what it seems to me is happening these days. Human beings are simply not equal. There are no equal human beings on this planet. And yet, the state's attitude, and most individuals who support the state, is to make people equal. And if they aren't, well, chop them up. You cut them up to make them equal. If this man has more money than his neighbor, take it away from him and give it to the poorer fellow. If this man is smarter than the other one, well, take the dumber one and send it to school at the expense of the richer one. This is the general trend. Punish those who have more, think more, are more creative, more energetic, more thrifty, more competent, and more ability, and reward those who have less. Make people equal when they are not naturally equal. Human beings are not naturally equal. They do not have equal heights. That's rather obvious, unless you start amputating legs and stretching necks and things like that. Normal people under normal circumstances are not of equal height. This does not make the shorter person worse than the taller one. Some very short people have been pretty smart, and some very tall ones have been pretty stupid. There's no general correlation either way. But people are not equally tall, they're not equally fat, they're not equally intelligent, they don't have equal minds, equal desires, equal ambitions, equal ability to make money, ability to save money, ability to be thrifty. They don't have equal desire to be thrifty. They don't have equal fingerprints. They don't have equal footprints, and they don't have equal halitosis. And on all characteristics, human beings are naturally different. What does the Declaration of Independence say? Because the Declaration was written by a genius, and it's correctly worded. It doesn't say all men are equal. It says all men are created equal. That's something else. That means that they are equal before the laws of nature. That is, two men, one rich, one poor, one tall, one thin, one male, one female, one smart, one stupid. They both walk off a cliff, the law of gravitation will affect them the same way. They both fall down just exactly the same way. And it doesn't matter that they don't like it. And it doesn't matter that they don't understand why. It also doesn't matter that they wrote their congressman they want the law repealed. It doesn't matter if he is the congressman. He'll fall down too. Human beings are equal before the laws of nature. That is what is meant by equal creation. You are affected by the laws of nature equally. Now what you do with your equal opportunity before the laws of nature, that will determine where you end up. If you think I'm reading something into this that isn't there, I refer you to the sentence before it, which I already read you, and it clearly says, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. And that's the creation of equality that is referred to. Equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. Now human beings don't get their so-called rights from any higher or authority of man. There is no organization of men that can grant a human being a right. There are only other people who can attack your ability to control your own life. The Declaration of Independence clearly says, and intelligently words the following concept of government, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Who's higher? The individual human being is higher, and the government is instituted to secure his rights and is under. That is the revolution of the American Republic, that the government is under the individual, and that the individual is sovereign and not the so-called government. That is the real significance of the American Revolution, which is why I claim that the American Revolution can be briefly identified with the Declaration of Independence itself, because it's the clear-cut articulation of what the revolution means and signifies. It has nothing to do with the fact that there happened to be a rebellion going on at the same time. Had that rebellion been going on without this Declaration of Independence and the philosophy behind it, then this would have been just another one of these Belgian-Congo deals separating from their mother country to create more disorder internally and have more havoc and rioting and just general upheaval internally. And we would have had our own internal problems forever after. It would never have improved. The revolution is the elevation of the individual to supremacy over the state. I have a very touchy question to ask here. How many of you noticed the next sentence? That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. This is the least quoted part of the Declaration of Independence these days. Today, to suggest that our present form of social coercion is unacceptable is called treason. Nevertheless, either we accept this thing or we don't. And even our so-called government puts the original of this. This is not the original. This is a facsimile we printed. You see, I understand it, but unfortunately, I don't have ability to control the original. The original is under the control of those who don't understand it. The original is framed and kept under glass and armed guard in the National Archives or someplace. I saw it many years ago at the Library of Congress. I understand they moved it to the National Archives. And it seems always interesting to me that there's an armed guard hanging over this thing, and it seems to me that, if anybody wanted to molest that document, they'd shoot him. That's what the guard is for. But if they leave the document alone and enshrine it and then violate everything it says, then they elect him president. That's the difference in our perspective. The point I'm emphasizing is, this document clearly says that whenever any government is destructive of these ends, it ought to be altered or abolished. Now, does this sound like treason? I frankly confess that from the political mentality standpoint, this sounds like treason, and yet that's not what's being advocated. But I don't think it's proper to throw over a government in a military or violent sense. I think it's totally improper. That's not a true revolution. I just got through saying a true revolution is peaceful. That's the way crackpots operate. They throw the old gangster out to put a new one in. But the Declaration of Independence itself was a peaceful concept. It happened to be going on during wartime. But let me remind you, the author of the Declaration of Independence did not start the war. The war was going on already for over a year without his active help to start it. I have never maintained, and do not now, and as a matter of fact, I would strongly dispute that the American Rebellion, starting on April 19, 1775, wouldn't have occurred without Thomas Paine. I think if Thomas Paine had never been born, that rebellion would have happened. Paine had nothing to do with that. That rebellion was simply the hallmark of dissatisfied, disgruntled people living under the yoke of a tyrant, wishing to express themselves effectively and not knowing how to do it. And so they did what all other people before them or since them have done. They rebelled militarily. And they wouldn't have accomplished a darn thing had that been the only thing that happened. If that's the only thing that would have happened, if Paine had not been born, the rebellion would have happened, and one of two things would have happened. Either the British would have won, or the British would have lost. These are the two things that could have happened. Had the British won, the American colonists would have been back under a British king, a few rebels would have been treated as traitors and hanged, and we could have another round of this bickering, and maybe 20 years later another rebellion might have started, and so on. Or, if the British had lost, which is the less likely, incidentally, it would have been less likely that the British would have lost. It would be more likely that they would have won without the revolution. But had they lost, and the Americans did succeed in defeating the British militarily, then one of two things would have happened again. Either the Americans would have reconciled with Great Britain and have made peace treaty under more favorable terms, and the Americans would have gotten a few representatives in British Parliament, and things would have been hunky-dory for maybe a year or two, until they got dissatisfied with the new state of affairs and would have started a new route. Or, under even less probable circumstances, the Americans might have asked for independence and gotten it, without the principles expressed here, and they would have gotten an American king. So these are the three possibilities. Either the British would have won, and America would have remained a set of British colonies, or America would have won and Britain lost, in which case reconciliation with Great Britain would have been the order, but under more favorable circumstances for the American colonists, or total independence as a state with an American king. The revolution changed this. The revolution was peaceful. It happened to occur during wartime, but it was two separate events going on simultaneously. And one had nothing to do with the other than the fact that they occurred at the same time, and the thing that made the acceptance of the revolution more simple was that the people were already riled up in terms of their rebellious activities in a wartime. In other words, I will admit, the wartime spirit might have gotten them just a little bit braver in declaring true principles in terms of Paine's ideology. I should say that there is a conservative element in the Declaration of Independence to make everybody a little happier. It does say, prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown, please note the word hath, I'll be mentioning that next session for a particular reason, there's a word hath in there which has quite a bit of significance. But in any event, accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable, etc., etc. It says, well, don't just act in haste, and as long as things are just mildly tolerable, or accept it, but only if it gets really bad, then you should not take that. So this means that don't act on the first impulse. That's sort of a conservative warning. Well, wait till it's really important, and then make your main thrust count, in other words. Now, I have something else to say about the Declaration of Independence. This is the greatest document ever penned by a man, and this was penned by a man, you know that. This is not a committee document, is that? Is that clear? I mean, I know most of you have heard that it was written by Jefferson, and some of you may have not realized it was written, but it really was written by someone. This was not composed by a committee. Whether it was Jefferson or Paine, it was still written by one man. How can you tell? Have you ever seen anything written by a committee that sounds like that? Forceful, energetic, uncompromising, no weasel wording. There is not a weasel word in the entire thing. It's right. It reads beautifully, eloquently, articulately. It's written by a person who had energy and principles with lots to spare and not a single compromise in his makeup. Now, the Constitution of the United States was written by a committee. And by comparison, they read differently. Now, I'm not going to go into that in this short course. There's a difference in the way they read. But the Constitution is not an expansion or an elevation of the Declaration of Independence. It's actually a retrogression. That's written by a committee, and this has been changed, and that has been changed, and blah, 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 and this has been weevil-worded, and that has been compromised, negotiated, and emasculated, and enervated, and de-energized. And so you have nothing but political compromises in the whole thing. The Constitution is a political document. The Declaration is not. When did the American Revolution hit its main high point? On the day that the ink dried. And from that point on, it's been going downhill ever since. This document is really merely a historical statement of the principles and purposes. It never really was effectual in creating a free society. It was a direction to go in, which was not fulfilled. But that direction still exists. Everything in the Declaration of Independence, properly interpreted in terms of 20th century semantics, can be retained. And you might look upon the Declaration of Independence as a stepping stone to freedom from which we can go much higher. This document will last in the history of freedom. And everything that has happened in the United States ever since then has acted to counter this main thrust for freedom. But it has had a long-term effect. It does not mean that the day after the ink dried, everything fell apart. It just meant that we weren't at the same high peak. Things went from January 10th, when this little pamphlet or booklet of Thomas Paine came out, from January 10th till July 4th, when the thing shot up like a skyrocket. And then it hit a peak and then started tapering off, which the last two centuries have seen. It didn't come down like this, suddenly, but rather very gradually. But now the rate has accelerated, so it's almost like a cliff. But it came down very slowly, and during that high point, that plateau that was reached, the United States was built up as a nation. And now the end is at the inside. I know you won't accept that this early, but I'm not intending it that way. I'm just pointing it out as a conclusion out of context, as I warned you there would be some. The Declaration of Independence didn't just spring out of nothing. Even if you believe Jefferson wrote it for historical reasons of your own, meaning that you went to school and learned it that way. But it didn't just spring out of nothing. Whoever wrote it, Paine or Jefferson, it came out of something else, a philosophy. That philosophy is in common sense. The Declaration of Independence merely formalizes it in an official document with nice, beautiful handwriting, and someone obviously went to a great deal of trouble to pen this thing, you know. Today we tend to lose sight of the colossal amount of effort that went into this, because today everything is typeset, and it wouldn't be done in this beautiful way as it was in those days. It was handwritten. I believe it was Timothy Matlock, actually, whose handwriting appears here. I'm not quite sure, but I think it's a man called Timothy Matlock. He did a nice job. There were only two errors in it, and he left out a syllable there, and rather than write the whole thing over, he just put it in on top of the word representative is called representative, and he left out a DN, and there's one other mistake someplace. Oh, here, there's an insert there. He left out the word only. But when you get down this far, you don't want to rewrite it, so. The point is, this is a beautiful document, but where does it come from? What are its intellectual roots? I've already pointed out that Thomas Paine, and even further back, Isaac Newton. I'll explain why that is in the second session of this course. But at this moment, let me explain what the significance of Thomas Paine's writing, Common Sense, was with respect to the Declaration of Independence. This pamphlet, Common Sense, this booklet appeared on January 10th, 1776. By April 8th, which is less than 3 months later, it had sold 120,000 copies. You may say, well, that's not very many. Well, with today's high-speed presses, and with today's population, it might not appear as so much. Although even today, anything that sells 120,000 copies in 3 months is quite a bestseller even today. To hit the bestseller list in books, you only have to reach something like 10 or 20,000. So this would be a bestseller even by today's standards. But this isn't today's standards we have to measure it by. In those days, printing was not done by high-speed presses, but done with painstaking difficulty. And we were living under much more primitive technological conditions, and printing was not the fast and highly developed art and technology that it is today. Moreover, the total population of the American colonies at that time just barely exceeded 3 million. And to be on the same scale, in proportion to population, this would be something like 7 million copies in 3 months today, on the same population scale. By July 4th, which is the actual date of the Declaration of Independence's official signing and proclamation, Common Sense had actually sold 500,000 copies. That's 500,000. That is one for every six people in the colonies, and at that time, very, very large percentage of the people, I don't know what the percentage is, but a far larger than today, couldn't read, so it wouldn't do them any good if they had it. And it was read to them. And the fact that 500,000 copies sold, the chances are that well over 1 million people had directly either read it or heard it. For example, George Washington had it read to his troops. That would be the equivalent of something like 30 million copies today, with today's population. In half a year, this completely changed the flavor of the times. This thing was a firebrand in philosophy. It was not trash. It was probably the highest grade literature that ever caught on. It's amazing that it did. The reason that it did, Paine thought like an intellectual and wrote for the masses. That's a combination that has almost never appeared in the history of the world. He was able to write in such a way that the greatest minds of his time could see the logic of what he wrote. And by the way, the greatest minds of his time happened to be living in the same country he was in at the time. It so happened that with the less coercion that existed here, the greatest minds had the ability, or more accurately, those minds which had the ability to disclose their content in the greatest manner lived here. Not the least of whom was Thomas Jefferson and George Mason and James Madison. And the greatest mind of all was Benjamin Franklin. I don't know how many of you realize it, but Benjamin Franklin was one of the greatest scientists of the 18th century. And if there had never been an American Revolution, he would still be remembered as one of the great physicists of that period. Most people don't think of him as a physicist because the American Revolution got in the way of his reputation as a physicist. Now, the question is, what was in this thing that could be so powerful that it could intellectually sweep the great minds such as Franklin and Jefferson, appeal to them, and still appeal to the average person, the man in the street, who was practically illiterate? Well, the fact was that Paine could write in terms of images, which swept the imagination of those who were within earshot or eyeshot of what he wrote. And I'm going to give you a few examples of this in a little while, but I think it would be well if you had an intermission at this point.
Session 1 continues on Disc 2.